Welcome to season one of Inspiration Loves Company. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Debbie Epstein Henry, a lawyer turned entrepreneur, public speaker, and author. The essence of this podcast is about doing better and being better at life, work, and everything in between. Our guest today is Rashid Silvera. Rashid is an educator. He taught for more than 40 years, including 35 years as a social studies teacher at Scarsdale High School in Scarsdale, New York. Rashid is also a professional model. He is among the few Black male models who graced the covers of renowned magazines in the 1980s, including GQ. He was also the first Black male to model in select national advertisement campaigns, including Polo Ralph Lauren. The topic we'll explore today is Model Citizen, Teaching Tolerance with Rashid Silvera. We first met when I was a sophomore in high school in 1982, and Rashid was my social studies teacher. Mm-hmm. He was my absolute favorite. So I took another class with him my senior year, which was an elective in psychology. And then I went on, no coincidence, to be majoring in psychology in college. Rashid was not only an inspiring teacher, but he became a treasured friend. Let's start with a huge welcome to my friend Rashid. How are you? Wow, to be talking to you like this.
Oh, fine. This is fantastic. I'll take any venue I can to reconnect with my birthday twin.
Okay, so you say my birthday twin. That's one of our very many things that we have in common. You gave me a big birthday surprise my senior year in high school. Can you share that story?
Well, I'll follow you with it. I think, where did we go?
Well, it was, you remember that you went to a black tie affair the night of my birthday, and our birthday, I should say.
You helped me with that.
Oh, no. Here we go again. This is like the Socratic method. You're the teacher again. I'm the interviewer here. Should we save the story?
Go ahead. Okay. Go for it.
Here's my recounting of it. So I'm a senior in high school. It's 1984, December 8th. And you come into class the next morning and say, stay after class. I have a birthday gift for you. And I said, well, what is it? And you said, well, last night I went to a black tie affair and I sat next to Andy Warhol and I handed him my dirty cloth napkin from the event. You're laughing, I hope, and not crying. And you said, can you write birthday wishes for my favorite student? And he said, sure. And then he said, tell me how to spell her name. And it says on this dirty cloth napkin, dear Debbie Epstein, misspelled, happy birthday, big heart, love, Andy Warhol. That's my recollection.
Don't know the backstory. The backstory is I'm at this event. And normally speaking, what Halston, what these people would do is they would always sit me at the end of the table with Truman Capote and Andy, because they thought the conversation would be more animated, it would be more give and take. But for me, it was always a problem because Andy and Truman sounded alike. Andy was, Rashid. And Truman was, Rashid. It was the same voice, but they could not have been more dissimilar in terms of their look and the way they carried themselves. So what happened was when I asked Andy to do that, Truman wanted to do it too. And I thought, you know, I'm having this conversation in my head. I can't, it loses the flavor. It dilutes it if too many people are in on this happy. And Givenchy was sitting across, Hubert Givenchy was sitting, and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. was sitting to my left. So all these people were witnessing this down this end of the table, were witnessing this happy birthday, Debbie. And I don't know. Your name was misspelled because Truman pointed out that, Andy, can't you spell? Aren't you supposed to be? And then Andy said, well, you're the writer, you know.
Remarkable.
I'm telling you, you have no idea what was going on at this. And my ex-wife, God bless her, sitting down at the table with all the models and Halston and, you know, and Rudy Gazzuti down the other end. Do you still have that?
Of course I have that. Who would not have assigned Andy Warhol with a misspelling of your name and a big heart that you got from your favorite high school teacher when you were 17 years old?
I'm sorry, you're just making me laugh and you've raised goosebumps.
I can't believe I never knew the full context, but thank you for that. And I feel like now our listeners have to hear what is the backstory on you. And so let's start with exploring your life as an educator. You started teaching at Scarsdale High School in 1981.
Correct.
Talk about that experience. What was it like for you to join that community at that time?
What it was hand meeting glove. If anybody had known that my grandfather, my mother's side, was a famous teacher in Jamaica, I literally had that in the system of my genes, whether or not I knew it. I was pathologically curious, and I wanted to be in an environment where folks were as interested in learning in a very coordinated fashion. They weren't racing to answers, but enjoying the journey. And that's when I knew that I wanted to be a teacher, but I wanted to be a teacher student surrounded by student teachers.
But what was fascinating to me is right around this time where you're making this transition to this new community where you end up staying for 35 years, you start a career as a professional model. So
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. These are not careers that are typically aligned. So how did that modeling life evolve for you? And how did that parallel or conflict with your identity as a teacher?
Ooh, brilliant. Now, there's the question. Well, I had been in the mix because of my ex-wife, who was an outstanding, handsome, intelligent, you know, just a very proud woman. And I was proud of her. But so I had been around these designers, but never was I visually interviewing. You know, I wasn't standing or posing in such a fashion. I knew I was the frame and I was happy with that job. Okay.
Right.
The work of art was my wife. However, creative people always have their eyes open as such. So what would eventually happen? I hope this is appropriate to tell this story. So here I go.
I hope so.
I have a friend whose name is Eddie Bianchi, who's a famous commercial director, married to a wonderful human being, Carla. His first wife was Armin Giraldi, who was Bob Giraldi's sister. And these are iconic commercial directors.
Right.
So Eddie Bianchi had a place between Davis Park and Fire Island. There's a place called Water Island. So I was out at Water. Now, Fire Island is very gay, and Davis Park is very family oriented. And me, as my gay friends call me, being the flaming heterosexual, it would be perfect that I would be between normalcy and, you know,
not normalcy.
Thank you.
Right.
So I'm on the beach with a girlfriend. This is after my divorce, well, during my separation, whatever. And we're playing Kadima. I guess it's sort of volleyball on the beach, but we're both buck naked.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Okay. Now, don't forget, Water Island is between, but very private. Okay.
Okay.
But next door, Perry Ellis lived next door. And Perry and Zoltan Brandisi, who was at his modeling agency called Zoli, very, very ooh-la-la. This were Jack Nicholson and Warren and all these cats used to hang out. But these cats see me on the beach, you know, playing. Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't that far away.
Okay.
They didn't need a telescope, although they may have had one. So they call Eddie Bianchi. Now, understand, Eddie and I are very, very close. So they call Eddie and say, who is that guy out there on the beach? Is he a part of your fellowship? And he said, you mean that guy? Oh, he says, yes. He said, well, we'd love to meet him. We think he could be a model. Perry, now, what do you say he wants to? Now Perry was beautiful. Okay, absolutely. Picture beautiful. Eddie says, Rashid, you know, you need to call these guys because they're interested. They think you could be a model. I'm going, dude, I'm teaching this guy's life, man. I'm not even trying.
Right.
You know, my ex-wife, I'm good.
Right.
He says, dude, call them. He keeps on harassing me about calling them. I eventually call them. I go into the modeling agency. It was on 50-something street at that time. Okay. And I walk in, all these beautiful people. I meet Zoli. I like him immediately. And the people around you, they're just good people. They think I'm the new model. I just came in to say, hey, man, you know what? I'm flattered. He says, well, you know, do me a favor. We'll just have some people take some pictures of you. Yeah, like some of the most famous photographers in the world. Okay, so I take these pictures. Next thing you know, it's this and it's that. Enrico Pullman takes my picture and I'm on the cover of GQ.
I remember it well. I think it was the April issue of 1983. Is that correct?
1983. And the story that you don't know is I'm in class probably teaching UCATs.
Yep.
Mary Pitt, who was the only other brown person at that high school. She was the main secretary of the general office and a queen, a wonderful, oh, my majesty and royalty all mixed together. I get the message is, because you have a phone in the classroom, Rashid, there's someone on the phone from Condé Nast. You need to come down and talk to them. Oh, no. She puts the call through.
Right.
Puts the call through three times and I hang up because I think it's someone. This is like a joke.
Right.
So someone comes down and says, Rashid, you'd come down to the office, the general office. And someone said to me, listen, this is John Shaheen. I'm the editor and such and such of GQ magazine. You're going to be on the cover in April. We want to make sure we have the name and everything. I said, we need to please come down to Condé Nast building. I have nothing to say. I go down to the building. And when you're on the cover of GQ and you go to Condé Nast, your picture is everywhere. So I go down and it's so, as you said, not in the same lane as teaching. It was actually a blessing because there was no emotional competition.
Right.
I could love my students completely without sharing that form of love and interest and caring with my colleagues or modeling contemporaries.
Rashid, I mean, there's so much to unpack in these stories and things, but just on the novelty that you are and that you have always been. We met at such a different time. I was actually at your GQ launch party at Studio 54,
but
I was also your student. Is there anything lost from those times when we met? Is there anything we should mourn from that you were able to be that novelty in two different worlds? And there was, in a lot of respects, a lot less judgment and eyes on you and all of us for being in that universe together.
Well, that question is interesting. Eventually, I literally had to, how can I put this nicely, almost try to diminish my participation in the fashion world while I was at Scarsdale High School. Now, understand, your parents were very savvy. These people were not folks who didn't know what was going on. I had to try to tamp that down.
You mentioned just in passing that this one other woman, Mary, was the only other brown person at Scarsdale High School at the time. And you also mentioned about how you just had this hand in glove, warm reception from the Scarsdale community.
Correct.
This was, an upper middle class, mostly white community. And was part of that pressure on you to tamp down? Do you think there was racism behind that? What was that? Or was that just more of an old fashioned provincial mindset of, you can't do two things?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I need to give Mary more credit than just a passing reference. So I think that she may have smoothed whatever road might have been rocky for me because of her majesty, that she had such affectionate respect that, and also it was very clear that she and I connected. She was very proud of me and I felt especially comfortable because of her. I mean, I was comfortable because of the whole energy. It didn't hurt that Mary Pitt was in that general office. These are conversations I had in my own head.
What I've had experienced in my conversations with Black colleagues is that a lot of them today are worried about showing their affinity for fear that it will jeopardize their credibility, as if they were only supporting or sponsoring a person because of that shared affinity. And was that a fear you had back then with Mary Pitt? And also, how should people of color address that challenge today?
In the case of Mary Pitt in particular, I realized that if I did not act honestly, if I did not give her the integrity of my humanity, I would even make the situation more tricky. I see this brown woman who has this bearing and this majesty, and quite honestly, it is so familiar to me. What she gave me was what the women in my life, what I was used to seeing and feeling and respecting. And I was fortunate enough to understand what she was trying to say, and I've never said this before, make me proud of you, Rashid. Mm. Operate in the context of this school, of this environment. You're not here by mistake, but now is not the time for mistakes. Give it your best. Give us your best. Make me proud of you. And all I could think of was, my God, in that moment, I was so proud of her. There she was, and I knew she had not gotten there by mistake. So it was a ceremony of celebration and recognition that we were from the same tribe, but we also know and knew that oftentimes when there are so few Black people in an environment, they're almost embarrassed by one another. They don't know if the same type of, shall we say, hard work has given them the opportunity to be and to share and to enjoy. So with Mary Pitt, that's why every day, that was my first stop.
Right.
I wanted to trim my sails. I almost presented myself in front of her so that she could say, and maybe not with words, but with a glance, you know, with a type of body language that said, okay, you're ready for today's task.
There's something really poignant in what you're saying, which is what I've read and experienced when talking to Black colleagues and friends is this notion of really being a representative. And when you are among the very few, that pressure is heightened because this person, if they act a different way, then that potentially will reflect on you. And that is a lot of pressure, particularly in the workplace. And I want to actually use that as a really nice segue into the fact that you've since retired, and then recently you spoke at a Black Lives Matter rally. Oh. You shared a very poignant story about a police officer, interestingly, in your life. I wanted you to take us, if you would, through that story and what that person meant to you.
Well, let's just do it this way. There was a little boy growing up in Roxbury, Massachusetts, who was a little upside down and distinctly wobbly. He was not a bad person and had come from a good family, but I think that I thought I was older than I was. I was more attracted to the older cats in the neighborhood, most of them who were athletes and wonderful, but just a little slice of cats who were just doing bad things. Yes, I was a little athlete and all of this, but I get involved in some this and that, and I end up at the Mary Gertrude Godwin Reform School for Boys. So I eventually get out of this school, and I'm in the streets, I'm in the Strasse, you know, and I'm trying to reconnect with my old cats, but Arnold James lives down, I lived on Townsend Street, and Arnold James lived down the street as well. He and his sister, God bless her. And these cats remember me from playing in the street, a good bad boy. But Arnold James knows that I'm now back in the mix. And this guy, this police officer, becomes my guiding light. This guy talks to me. He tells me what's up. He gives me a clearer version of True North. He allows me to be prouder of doing the right things that my grandparents and aunts and uncles had put on my map in the first place.
So Arnold James was a Black police officer, right?
A very brown-skinned police officer.
So during this interview, I've used the term Black and you used the term brown. I actually see you in Technicolor, but in truth, you've often traversed that gray area. You were a pioneer Black teacher and model, both in largely white circles. With sexuality, you mentioned your gay friends affectionately call you a, quote, flaming heterosexual.
Yes.
I love that term. And as you put it, quote, a very brown-skinned police officer, Arnold James, was your, quote, guiding light. So I wonder how your advice is relatable for those who have not similarly straddled the multitude of worlds that you have.
Well, let me get back to Arnold James, the police officer, who in fact was my guiding light, my true north. And in the process of dealing with me personally and helping me, you know, just set my course a little bit more clearly, he did share with me the notion of behavior in front of the police or within the context of their community. Now, this is a police officer who will eventually become detective, allowing me to see myself through the eyes of a policeman who may be, shall we say, looking for someone who's committed a crime. He had always told me to be still. So it was quite apparent to me early on that whether I was guilty or innocent of anything, in front of the police, I needed to be calm. I needed to be clear, and I needed to listen to what they wanted from me and give that to them, regardless how upset I would be in my righteous indignation. And I'll be doggone if that didn't bear truth in life, because I was almost the least, the guy going forward after Arnold straightened me out, I was not a troublemaker. I was not that guy that the police were looking for. But in almost every situation where I was in an environment where police were there, you know, I never felt fully comfortable. I didn't think they were there to necessarily protect my rights, but to pretty much surveil my behavior. And I got that beautiful piece of advice, what I would call survival, from a police officer in my community.
So Arnold James's generosity in sharing that insight with you, obviously was very powerful for you personally. But the sadness in that story is the fact that you had to be told that, because that reality and that bias is there. So the question is really, how do we get rid of that bias? What is required so that people and boys like you wouldn't need to be taught that anymore? What needs to change to eradicate that bias?
I've heard people talking about police training. Defunding the police doesn't mean taking money away from them, but to redirect it into better training. And I'm thinking on both ends, we need to see police outside of the context of just people who are there to arrest or to, you know, or to detest or to somehow find fault with what you're doing. But police have to learn to do the same thing. Regardless of how guilty, how much you may relate to a particular standard or profile, the presumption of innocence must always be there on both sides.
I think it leads really nicely into a bigger topic around systemic change, and particularly with your educator hat on, we really need to think about how to educate our young people differently to be able to face and confront systemic racism. And how do we do that differently, both in our homes as well as in our schools?
Well, you just hit it, Debbie. You said in our homes as well as. I don't draw that line with a thick demarcation. You know, it's a dotted line. Home is school and school is home. We allow the students to be teachers. In other words, what I shared with my students, the facts matter, and the facts don't always reveal themselves instantly. Opinion is much more easily found or exclaimed than facts. You know, how do you feel about something? You can give them in a moment. But what do you actually know about it? So I always wanted my students to not put their hands over their mouths or their hearts when they wanted to feel a certain way about something. But the facts would give you a more intelligent look at what you were trying to explain.
It's really about learning and being in a constant state of listening and knowing.
So that whole notion of learning and knowing that if you can continue to nourish curiosity, then that's more than half the journey. Keep these people interested in learning.
That level of engagement is exactly what it's about. Another thing that I see as a real risk, particularly now in the pandemic and with people working remotely, there's a lot of concern around marginalized groups who may already feel somewhat invisible, either in the workplace or in the schools, that now it's even more acute because they are not able to have that ability to make the one-on-one personal connection. I just wonder if you have recommendations along these lines of how to address that, again, particularly for marginalized groups where it's going to be that much harder to make those connections.
I think that you might want to use the invisibility as a positive and just say, truly funnel the energy that you would use to jump to a conclusion because of seeing something or someone, and try to feel your mind with the intention of speaking your mind. Because we are more invisible, we need to be more audible. It can be more beneficial to speak your mind without being seen, because you might be encouraged to listen more closely and more carefully.
I love that suggestion. And it's funny, not until you mention this now, did I see the pandemic as an opportunity to get us to listen more. I think it's a really wonderful point. Is there an idea that you either want to underscore, or if there's something that I've missed or gotten wrong that you want to clarify? What do you want to leave our listeners with?
If you have an opportunity, please interview some children. The questions that you ask children may not come back to you in complex compound sentences. In their infancy, have a certain type of honesty and authenticity that when you ask them a question, they'll attempt to really answer your question. I am still trying to do. I'm training my eyes to look beyond the surface. If you could let your eyes be more closely connected with your heart, you would be more apt to see people as who they truly are. Sometimes people, you know, confuse you with their nervousness. So I would say, connect your eyes more closely with your heart so that you can try to see what people are trying to to share. More often than not, if they're hurt, they're saying, help me. And if they're strong, they're saying, let me help you.
Rashid, what a beautiful and fitting way for you to conclude. I think your suggestion about interviewing children is so smart because it would hopefully distill all of the noise out of the room and really be able to focus in on what are the important issues at hand. So I really appreciate that recommendation. I want to thank you so much for not just who you are, but what you've given and brought to me personally and so many other students and friends. And also for today's amazing conversation. I know these conversations are really hard, and that's part of the reason why we have to continue to have them.
Right. So thank you very much. And don't forget, Debbie, my God, girl, you continue to nourish and to elevate people past and present.
Thank you so much for that. I also want to thank our incredible podcast team, creative director and copywriter, Susie Rubin, executive assistant and events coordinator, Renee Green, podcast producers, Cortland Brennan and Sam Barber. And if you are enjoying our new podcast, Inspiration Loves Company, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, rate and review us, tell your family and friends and colleagues, and we hope you join us next time. Thank you again so much, Rashid.
God bless you.